Hey, welcome to the B-side. This is episode 2. I am Adam.
Oh, I'm Steve. That's me.
I like it. If you didn't catch in, we explained on the previous episode why we called it the B-side, and we started talking about why we go to church and the purpose of that. So to understand why we go to church and this gathering, we also need to understand what makes a church a church. And so we're going to dive into that this week. So, piece number one, what makes a church a church? Is there a magic formula? Is it the amount of people? Is it the building you're in?
Okay, well, for this you kind of have to go back a little bit, because for like 1,500 years, people went, well, there's one church, the Roman Church, Roman Catholic Church, and so what makes the church? The church is the institution, and it was really, really simple. It was obvious, what's the church? The church is the church. But then at the Reformation, they were really wrestled with this, because can you be a church and not be under the Pope? Can you, like, because they're, so now they're going, what is it? And there's all these new movements at the time of the Reformation. So that, that question, no one was really asking that question for like 1,400 years, because it was pretty obvious in their view. And so it wasn't really a, but at the Reformation, it became a real, you know, debated, important question, because can you, if you're not under the Pope, are you a part of the church? Because the view would have been the church is everyone who's under the authority of the Pope, basically. Mm. And so, okay, what do you do at the Reformation? So the Reformers, what they did is they came up with this idea of what is a true church. And they said there's basically two things that makes a church, and you have to have them both, or you don't have a church. If you have these things, then you are a church. A true church exists wherever there is number one, the right preaching of the gospel. So the word is open, the gospel is proclaimed. If you're not proclaiming the true gospel, biblical doctrine, they would say the Bible and the truth of the Bible, right theology. If you're not proclaiming the truth, you aren't a church. So you're a heretic, not a church. It's not a true church where the word is wrong. So that was actually their critique against Catholicism, is they're saying, hey, they're obscuring, hiding the gospel. So they're saying, we're not the true church. We're not sure they're a true church because of their they're not rightly preaching the word, and the gospel's not being proclaimed. You don't have a church if the gospel's not being proclaimed. So number one, the right proclaiming of the gospel. The number two thing the Reformer said that you have to have, the, you know, essential ingredients for a true church, is the right practice of the sacraments or ordinances. And so then there's a sub point here. Mm-hmm. Sub point one is baptism. You know, you're baptizing people. Sub point two is the Lord's Supper. Then implied in the Lord's Supper is the right administration of the Lord's Supper is there's some form of church discipline, that sin is being dealt with. There's purity in the church because there's local elders who, you know, if someone is in rampant sin, they're being removed from the Lord's Supper. And so there's a way to sort of guard the health of the church from sort of rampant immorality and these types of things. Because if there's a church where there's filled with rampant immorality, everyone's cheating on their spouses, and there's this, you know, all sorts of crazy stuff, and the leadership isn't addressing it, then that's not a true church, because they're not holy. They're living immoral lives. And how you deal with that is at the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper is the way that leaders say, yes, you're in, you're welcome, you're part of God's people in this local place. So the second one then was, you know, the right practice of the ordinances, the sacraments, baptism, Lord's Supper. Implied in that is church discipline and godly leadership. So if you have those things, the right preaching of the word and the right practicing of the sacraments, that's a church. You're even just, if you do those things, you are claiming to be a church. That's what makes a church a church. So there are things that don't have those two things, right? Like sometimes, like, there could be a guy on the street preaching, you know, street preacher. Yeah. Or like Billy Graham, right? At a Billy Graham thing, and he's out there preaching the gospel.
Big tent revival.
Big
style.
Tent. Yeah. So that's okay. That's one of those two marks, but that's not a church. So just because you're opening the Bible doesn't make you a church, mm-hmm. right? When you're really starting to claim to be a church is when you're starting to perform sacraments. You're baptizing people. You're taking communion. Those are the markers of what a church is. Baptism is the sign that you belong and you're welcoming people into your community. The Lord's Supper is keeping people in the community. You're active in that community. You've got your, this is how we shepherd and say these are the people that belong together. So preaching can be done in lots of contexts. Parachurch, evangelism, those types of things. But preaching combined with the sacraments, you are now acting like a church. You're claiming to be a church.
Once you start acting like a church, we are seeing and saying that there needs to be a required bar or measure and leadership to go, hey, this is what we're here for. This is what we're doing. And we have to actually be held accountable to what we're doing. So let's back it up. Point number one, speaking the truth, opening the Bible on a regular basis. It's not just name it, claim it, we're going to pray for it, hand out the Lord's Supper, and that's a church. It doesn't matter what name you put on the door, per se. It can say church on the door, but if we're not actually opening the Bible and sticking true to that, what is that?
Yeah,
it doesn't qualify us to be a church.
True church has biblical doctrine. It's being guided by the Lord. And the way the Lord guides his church is through the word. Mm. So if it's Christ's church, it's the word is being opened. So that's crucial, number one. So there's a bunch of organizations, institutions that have the word church, but they aren't a church, at least not according to Jesus. And this is where they fall, is number one, right? Yeah. They may practice the sacraments, but they don't open the word.
So if I'm a new Christian, though, how do I properly walk in and go to a church and go, hey, how do I test that water? Is it through personal study? Am I to be asking friends, discipleship? Like, as a new Christian, what do I do to avoid the pitfall of a fake church?
That's a good question. That's tough if you don't know anything. I think what you want to find is a church that actually opens, reads, and teaches the Bible is crucial.
So if we're reading through the Bible and we're on like chapter 2, verse 1, and next thing I know we're at like verse 10 and nothing from 2 to 9 was addressed, should any red flags go up? Or
I mean, we're talking about how do you, like, it could be fine. It could be like, there are great churches that don't preach through the Bible per se, that mm-hmm. they're faithful, sound churches.
Yep.
And there are churches that are not good that do. So it's not a hard rule, but I would say if I'm new to a community and I'm looking for a church, I would look for one that at least opens, reads, and teaches the Bible, because there's churches that just don't. They don't even open a Bible. And now I know it's just dangerous. It's just dangerous that way. And there may be a church, you know, I would send you to a church that opens, reads, and teaches the Bible. And I may not agree with them on everything. They may not get it all right. We may not get it all right. But at least they're trying to be under the authority of God and his word. And at least we're, you know, we may not land on all the same places. They're not perfect. But
they have a pursuit of
but
truth.
There's a pursuit. Yeah, there's a pursuit there, at least the right posture of we're under the word and we're trying to be under the word.
Reverence for God's word.
I feel like that's mandatory, and that's the point of number one is in the time of the Reformation, they weren't reading and teaching the Bible. The word was being kept from people in languages like the Bible's not in German. The German people cannot read it. They cannot hear it. They cannot understand it. And they kept doctrine and the word away from people. Mm-hmm. And that's why that was the big condemnation of that the Reformation brought against the Catholic Church, is they're keeping the Bible away from people. The Bible's our authority. The Bible needs to be in the hands of everyone. And there needs to be, you know, preaching, reading, teaching the Bible is, you know, number one, essential for what makes a true church.
Perfect. Okay, so we go to number two.
Yeah.
Let's dive into baptism. What if I'm listening to this and I'm going, okay, these guys are talking about what is and what isn't a church, and they say, okay, a church, read and teach the Bible, baptize people. Well, what's baptism all about? Some churches have infant baptism, other adult baptisms upon confession of faith. Let's walk through that baptism topic a little bit.
So baptism is the sign of incorporation into God's people to a local church. It is a sacrament of the local church. I'm not of the opinion that anyone can baptize anyone. I think it's given to the local church to administer as a sign of incorporation into a local church and part of the, you know, into Christ and his people. It's symbolic of the work that God has done in their lives and transformation. I believe in believer's baptism. We believe in believer's baptism, which means that baptism is administered to those who express faith, who believe in Jesus. Other people would disagree with me and argue for paedo baptism, which means you baptize your babies in hope, in an appeal to God, that they're included in the covenant people as our children of believers. Yeah. But we believe in credo baptism, believer's baptism, it's called. And that it's this symbolic, significant, meaningful symbol of obedience and of faith and putting the gospel on display, saying, I belong to Jesus and his people. And it's the initiatory rite. Hmm. I always compare it to, like, you can use a hockey analogy, The NHL draft, say, and you know, you get your pick and you announce someone, we're gonna draft this guy, and they call up this player and he puts on the hockey jersey, puts on the Canucks jersey, Brock Besser's putting on the jersey, and he's not gearing up because he's about to go out on the ice. He's got that, it's just ceremonial. But what it is he puts on the hat, he puts on the jersey publicly. They take the photos saying, this is my team now. I didn't belong to this team. Now I do belong to this team. It's sort of a ceremonial welcome rite. Yeah. First press conference, you know, photos in the jersey. It's this external sign of this changed reality. Yeah. I belong unclaimed to Jesus now.
Declaimed.
Yeah, I didn't belong. Now I do. And this is my team now. I belong to the Canucks. Or in our case here, we're saying, I belong to Team Jesus now, and this is what, I want everyone to know that. It doesn't save us, it's the external sign of the internal change.
Yeah. And if we follow up that baptism without, I don't want to skip past the Lord's Supper, but we talk about membership and under spiritual leadership. To be a member, we are saying you have to be baptized. Why is that important?
Baptism and membership, why do they go together?
Why do they go hand in hand?
Baptism is the symbolic act of saying, I belong to Jesus and his people. Mm-hmm. Membership is it's the willingness to be under the leadership of local leaders and saying, this is my covenant community. I'm going to pursue being the people of God with this community. I'm putting myself under these leaders. Because a local church is told, or, you know, elders are told to shepherd the flock of God among you. Who are those flock? That's the question. Who are the elders responsible for? Membership is our way. And there's a different ways you could do this, but membership is our way of saying, you know, I'm part of that flock. This is the group. This is the people that the elders are responsible for. So there's people who aren't members, who are saying to the leaders, don't shepherd me, don't come after me, I don't want discipline, I don't want leadership, I don't want discipleship, I don't want you to be responsible for me. Those who are members are saying, yeah, this is my covenant community, I'm gonna pursue following Jesus with you, I'm gonna serve, I'm gonna give, I'm gonna help, I want you to disciple me and train me, help me, come, you know, visit me and care for me. If I go off the rails and I'm ruining my life with something, come and talk to me and come pursue me. And so they belong together in that baptism, commanded by Jesus, is the official or sort of the public beginning of the Christian life. How can we say, okay, you're a member here, but you aren't obedient to that? Mm-hmm. So membership comes as sort of the follow-up to that It's saying, I'm belonging to this covenant community here. And the Lord's Supper is related to that membership. It's saying the Lord's Supper is sort of the ongoing rite, saying, I still believe in Jesus. I'm walking with Jesus and following him. And another week, and again, I reaffirm the gospel. It's sort of like the Lord's Supper is sort of the baptism renewal ceremony. We should do it as often as possible. We gather, we do it regularly, twice a month in our case. Maybe we should do it more often, and we've talked about it. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of the baptism renewal, gospel renewal, saying, yes, I still believe. And we are united as a church and united to Christ as we eat and drink, saying, yes, the body and blood of Jesus for me in my place again. And so they belong together.
With the Lord's Supper, is there a right way, wrong way to actually administer it? Should we all be drinking from one glass of wine and one piece of bread? Is it okay if we have gluten-free crackers and normal crackers?
I feel like that's a whole separate B-side you're opening up.
Maybe we need a B-side on,
I think maybe,
the sacraments.
But I think the short answer is, I don't think it's right and wrong, but I think there's better or worse ways, or pros and cons. And I think the goal should be, how close can we get to the original symbols? Hmm. So in the original symbols, you've got, you know, Jesus with his 12 disciples at the Last Supper, where he's initiating this thing. And they're having a meal together, and there's actual bread they rip up, and they pass around. There's actual wine that they drink, and the wine is symbolic of Jesus' blood shed for us, the bread, his body broken for us. And this is what we're told to do. I think there's better and worse ways, and that's related to how close the symbols remain. I don't think it's like right and wrong. But you want to stay close to those symbols.
Yeah.
So, you know, for instance, we use grape juice instead of wine, partly out of respect for those who don't drink alcohol. I think that's probably the reason. Yeah. In fact, fun fact, Welch's grape juice was invented so that for communion during Prohibition. There you go. Bit of trivia for you. And so we got the Welch's going. So is that wrong? We're not using wine? I don't think it is. I think grape juice is pretty close. It's a close thing. Now, if we were using like Coke, you know, a cream soda, you know, so I don't think it's morally right and wrong. You know, I've heard of like a youth group using like potato chips and cream soda. Is that right or wrong? I mean,
not
maybe
attack youth. Not attack. Not an argument. Ain't happening.
But so I mean, I think the goal is, how can we stay close to those symbols? Mm. There's challenges. Okay, so it's one thing you celebrate communion with 12 people. How do you do it with 200 people? Mm-hmm. How do you do it with 2,000 people? How do you do it, you know? And so I don't think it's about right and wrong. It's about how close can we get to those symbols and doing it. There's pros to, like, we all eat at the exact same moment. There's beautiful imagery in, we all eat from the physical same loaf. Mm. But when you have 200 people, you can't all eat from the same loaf. Like, there's not enough bread. Like, how big is this loaf, right? I think there's value. So there's pros and cons, and I don't think it's right and wrong, but it's about how can we do it in the right spirit and trying to honor the Lord. And we want to keep those symbols as close as
mirror
we can.
As accurately
while
as
changing.
Possible.
Yeah, like, our context is just different.
Yeah.
It's just different. Maybe those things aren't available where you're at. Like, I always think of, like, okay, like, we're not the only ones doing church. How do you do this in Africa? How do you do another? Maybe some of these things aren't available, you know. So, anyway.
Well, that sounds good to me. I'll have more questions about the actual communion process. Is Jesus' body in the blood and bread? Is he in that? Is it symbolism? Maybe we'll get into that 1 week here, and we'll have a little bit of discussion on the topics of that and the current debates going on. But for now, this has been the B-Side Episode 2, and we look forward to hearing from you. If you have any further questions, email us at bside@tachurch.ca. I'm Adam. This was Steve. Have a great day.
See ya.